Christmas is right around the corner. I want to thank you, especially those of you who have been praying for my mom. I know I mentioned last week that I was leaving after church to head for the airport to visit my mom. She's 94 years old now and was diagnosed with cancer at numerous parts of her body three weeks ago. I arrived, actually it was 2 o'clock Monday morning, and went to see my mom on Monday morning at 9, and it was just a good time to sit down with her. I think the word went around to some folks that she's actually getting better. I don't know exactly what that means. She is getting better. I kind of like the way Andrew Peterson has phrased it, of all the things that she's dying of, she's more alive than the rest of us, and I can promise you that. She is just waiting to go home. My brother asked her the other day if she was at all afraid or afraid of anything, and she looked at him and said, "What do I have to be afraid of? Are you afraid to go home?" She said to him, "I'm not afraid to go home." And that's really what she's waiting for. We believe it'll probably be a matter of weeks rather than a matter of months at this point. Her breathing has increased. The cancer is in her lungs. It's in her spine. She's shaking quite a bit. She quoted Psalm 91 to my sister-in-law the other day in the hospital, the entire psalm. I don't know how many of us here could do that, 94 years old or otherwise. And the only question that she has right now is, why does it take so long to die? That's what she's asking, you know, and so I explained to her that we're all on a journey together. All of us are on this journey. And some of us haven't gotten anywhere near the airport yet. Some of us have arrived there. We're milling around the shops. Some of us are making our way to the gate. I don't know which ones of you it is, but we're making our way to the gate. And some of us, I said to my mom, have gotten the final boarding call and are buckled into our seats. But if you fly at all, we've all had that experience where you buckle into your seat and they close the door and you sit there. And you sit there. And you sit there. And there's no announcements made as to why it's taking so long. They just sit there. But we all know that the pilot is not going to go anywhere until it's time to go somewhere, right? Would you agree with that? So I said to Mom, you know, it's a little harder to be patient when you're buckled into your seat, but the rest of us are watching. We need to see how you do this. And I have to tell you, as a pastor, I've attended a lot of deaths. I've stood beside a bed as people have passed into eternity. And I've never been with anybody who is looking with such enthusiastic anticipation to being face to face with Christ, her Savior. She's a remarkable lady. I'm leaving again tomorrow, and I'm going to tell you a story this morning that I hope is going to help you to understand. There's been a lot of unplanned interruptions in my time with you since we started on this journey together, and this one that starts tomorrow morning is the one that was not unplanned. This was planned more than a year ago. I leave in the morning and fly to Singapore and then transit through Singapore onto the Philippines. Next Sunday morning, I'll be speaking in a church in Metro Manila, and the Sunday after that, I'll be speaking in Singapore, and then on the Monday, I'll come back here. So mark it on your calendars. Delta willing, I would say Lord willing, but you know, Delta just has control over stuff like this. Delta willing, we will have our Bible study on Monday evening, December 17th. Monday evening, December 17th. So if you came to the Thursday Bible study that we had already, that Monday Bible study is going to cover the same stuff. We'll have another one the following Thursday, and that'll cover new stuff. So it's up to you. Make it to the Monday or make it to the Thursday, but we'd be glad to have you there. I have been busting your chops since I got here. I don't know if you're writing any of that down. Some people are writing stuff down. He's been busting my chops ever since. You know, I've been talking to you about hard times and trials and difficulties and how you should be willing to just kind of thrive in situations like that, and you should be thankful when your world begins to fall apart. And you're probably saying to yourself, if he keeps talking like that, I'm just going to stop listening. Some of you weren't listening when I was talking like that in the first place, and I understand that, because I go to church too sometimes, although usually I'm up here instead of out there, but I understand. And so this morning, I'm not going to bust your chops. I'm going to tell you a story. A story about, don't let me get ahead of myself. The Apostle Peter was a man who knew Christ very well. He had sailed the seas of Galilee with him. They had walked the hills of Judea together. When I told you that story about going back and forth between Jerusalem and Bethany in the last week that Jesus was alive here on planet Earth, Peter was with him on every one of those transits back and forth. Peter was a man who was in the inner circle, Peter, James, and John. They were the ones that Jesus considered to be his closest friends. Peter was there the day in the upper room that's recorded for us in John chapter 14, where Jesus says, "I go to prepare a place for you. In my Father's house there are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also." I don't know what it was like for Peter to live the rest of his life with those words echoing in his mind. That promise was real. That promise was tangible. And as Peter comes to the end of his life, he says in one of his letters, in that second of his epistles, he's very near to the point where he's dying. He's an old man. It's only a few months, perhaps, before they carried him away and crucified him upside down outside the city of Rome. And so as he writes this letter in 2 Peter chapter 3, he anticipates that a day is going to come when people would begin to mock the promise that Jesus made. When people would begin to say, whatever became of that promise? You remember he promised us a long time ago, right? It's 2,000 years ago by any measure, and he promised us 2,000 years ago that he was going to come back. Whatever happened to that promise? And I love the way Peter phrases it. You could go home and read it later on today in 2 Peter chapter 3. He talks about the voice that made the promise, "I will come again and receive you to myself." And then he references a point in time much earlier than that when he says, there was a time when there was no light on planet Earth, where it was just this roiling, seething, boiling mass of mud and unformed and unshaped. And a voice rang out in the darkness and said, "Let there be light." And there was. What Peter ends up saying is that the people who are mocking the promise that Jesus would come again need to understand. They are deliberately forgetting. That's the way he phrases it. They are deliberately forgetting that the voice that said, "I will come again," is the same voice that said, "Let there be light," and there was. The voice that said, "I will come again," is the same voice that said, "There's going to be a flood. I'm going to give man 120 years and then punch his ticket." And forgive me for phrasing it like that, but he said there would be a flood, and there was a flood, and the whole rationale that Peter is using is, look, the same voice said there would be a flood, and there was. He kept his promise, though many years had passed. And now, of course, 2,000 years is a long time. Would you agree with that? Somebody makes a promise, and 2,000 years later, the promise is still not fulfilled. There's a lot of people who might sit back and say, I don't know. Maybe he didn't mean it. Maybe he meant something else. Maybe. So the question I have today is, why hasn't he come back? Why hasn't he come back? Well, we can gather from what Peter said, and I'm going to put the reference up here on the screen so you have an opportunity to look at it. At the very end of that passage in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 10, Peter says, He says, whoa, dear, Okay, we were asking too much of Peter at that point. I and this PowerPoint do not play well together. I hope you've noticed that. 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 8 through 10 says, "But the Lord is not slow in keeping his promise, as some men count slowness." Some men consider slowness. You're going to know whether I'm actually getting this right. See, that's why I'm waiting, because I could just kind of jump on this, you know. "As some men consider slowness, but is patient with you." Understand this, he says, that with the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. So the Lord is not slow in keeping his promises, some men consider slowness, or some men understand slowness, but is patient with you, not wanting any to perish, but all to come to repentance. Did you hear those words? He's not slow in keeping his promise, because 1,000 years for him is like a day when it's gone by, and a day is like 1,000 years. He's not bound by time in the same way that we are. But he's being patient, he says. Listen, I don't know how to break this to you, but if your father made a promise to you 30 years ago that he would take you to the zoo, and he hasn't taken you yet, I don't know how to break this to you, but I don't think you're going to the zoo. 30 years go by like that. But with the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like a day. So he's not failing to keep his promise because he can't keep it, or because he's forgotten it, or because he said it without really thinking, or because he was making stuff up when he was talking. It's none of those reasons. He's waited 2,000 years because, according to 2 Peter, and I promise it says this, we could show you under normal circumstances, I promise it says this, it says he hasn't come back yet because he is being patient with you. In a place where you expect him to say, he's being patient with them, those people who haven't heard, those people who haven't repented, he's being patient with them to give them an opportunity, but that is not what it says. And I'll ask you to take my word for it until you can look it up later. It actually says, instead of saying he's being patient with them, it says he is being patient with you. You. You're you, raise your hand. Awesome. I'm schizophrenic and so am I. I get that. But he's being patient with you. So what it's saying is that this morning, he's being patient with you. He's patiently waiting for you to do something, and that's why he hasn't returned yet. Can you imagine? But what is it that he's waiting for? Well, Peter gives us the answer. He's waiting. He's being patient with you because he is not willing that any of them should perish, but that all should come to repentance. He's patiently waiting for you and for me to take the opportunity that we have to take the gospel to people who still need to hear it, because he's not willing that any should perish. I want to tell you a story this morning that for me illustrates this principle more than any other. I hope by the time I'm done, you're going to understand why it is that I keep running back and forth to the Philippines. But I want to tell you a story this morning, and it actually starts in some ways with a plane trip that I took one time. I spend a lot of time sitting on airplanes. And because most of the flights that I take are longer flights, I have the opportunity to sit there and, you know, eat the pretend food. And I don't know if you can picture me sitting in one of those seats actually trying to get food to my mouth while somebody next to me. And it's always somebody larger than me that's sitting in the middle seat. I don't know how that works. It just happens, you know. Well, in this particular flight that I was on, I was up there in the front row up by the bulkhead, and I was in the window seat. And over there in the aisle seat, there was nobody in the middle seat in between. Over there in the aisle seat, there was this lady that just kind of had this bling on, you know. She just was well-dressed and obviously wealthy and sitting there, and, you know, she was eating her food. And we did the thing that we always do when you meet somebody for the first time. the first thing we say is, you know, I say Jay Jackson, and she gave me her name. And then we ask the question that all Americans ask. The second question out of our mouths at times like this is what? What do you do? What do you do? And normally, here's the deal. Normally, I'm planning to share the gospel with the person that's sitting next to me. So I don't want them to know that I'm a missionary for fear that they'll just think I'm sharing the gospel just because I'm a missionary or a pastor. And so I don't tell them that. I tell them something like, I'm in communications, which is true. That's what I do. I communicate for a living. But on this particular occasion, I said to this lady, and I don't know why, I said, you know, well, actually, I'm a missionary, and I work with tribal people. And she made that noise that strikes terror into the heart of every man on planet Earth. It's not the shotgun noise. That's not what it was. It was, and ladies, you may have to help me with this, because I'm not as good at it as you are. Over the noise of the engines, I heard her go, can you help me with that, ladies? Cutting her meat. Oh, no, it was really clear from the body language that she's not liking this at all. So I said, well, okay. She said, well, I hope you don't mind my saying so, but I think you ought to leave those people alone. They're happy the way they are. I wanted to say... I wanted to say, I hope you don't mind my saying so, but that is the stupidest thing I have ever heard. That's what I wanted to say, but I didn't say it. And I don't know if there's extra credit in heaven, but I'm applying for it right now, Lord, because I didn't say it. I said, you know, that's not the first time I've heard that. I said, I'm going to guess something, I said. I'm going to guess, ma'am, you know, just looking at the jewelry and the hair. You've never visited a tribal group. Would that be true? Well, no, I didn't. I never have. I said, well, I don't want to get pushy here, but over the years that I've been in ministry, I've been with more than 100 tribal groups. And while I've often heard the sentiment, you ought to leave them alone because they're happier the way they are, I have to tell you, ma'am, I have always heard it from somebody like you. In her fancy hair and with her shiny jewelry. In all of my visits in more than 100 tribal groups, I have never had a tribal person, man, woman, or child, walk up to me and say, I wish the missionaries had left us alone because we were happier the way we were. It's always somebody. I said, ma'am, with your permission, I'd like to tell you a story. She didn't know how story-driven I am. I said, I'd like to tell you a story. And it has to do with a group of people that I know very well, a group of people that I've lived with over the years. I speak their language, but I need to take you back before. I said, would it be okay if I just told you a story? And she said, sure, you know, we're not going anywhere. That's the story I want to tell you this morning. It has to do with a group of people that call themselves the Bukalot. That's what they call their language. That's what they call their culture. Sometimes they refer to themselves as the Igongot, which Wongut means forest, and E means from, though they're the people of the forest. They live in the Sierra Madre, about 150 miles to 400 miles northeast of Metro Manila, in some of the prettiest piece of property on planet Earth. I'll show you some pictures later, just a quick video that will bring you up to speed. But there's these high mountains that go all the way up to 6,000 feet, and these rivers that wend in between them, and the rivers are this kind of emerald color. I mean, you've never seen a place like this before. Picture's worth 1,000 words, and so you'll see a picture. I think a visit is actually worth 1,000 pictures, because that's what people take when they come and visit these people. And I'm inviting you right now. If you want to come and visit, we'd love to have you come. I could take you along on one of these trips, and you could see it for yourself. The remarkable thing about Bukalot territory in the Sierra Madre there on the island of Luzon in the Philippines is that had you visited not so many years ago, the visit would have ended with you dead. I don't know how to say that any more kindly than that, and I know there are young ears listening. Some of the ears are young but are older than they seem. I'm going to tell you everything that's true. One of the real little ones is asleep, and so I'm just going to tell you this story. The reason that it would have ended that way is because the Bukalot were headhunters. I mean, not corporate headhunters, but real headhunters. Headhunting was so ingrained into their culture that it was impossible for a young man to get married unless he had taken a hit. Oh, there were all kinds of ceremonies that went with getting married. There were bride price to do, and one of my favorite parts of the wedding ceremony was prior to the wedding itself. Have you ever seen bamboo? You know how bamboo comes in these sections, and it's hollow in the middle, and they're usually about that big around. Well, they would take a piece of bamboo and cut it so that the closed off end was on one end, and it was open on this end, and the lady, the girl, the fiance. I guess they're both fiancés, but the fiancé, you know what I mean, with two E's, would put that piece of bamboo right here under her arm and stand kind of on that side of the stage, and her husband-to-be would stand on this side of the stage with a bow and arrow in his hand with the arrow aimed at the piece of bamboo. Now, the goal was to prove what a good hunter he was by putting the arrow right into the center of the bamboo. I mean, it was wonderful. This is a hallmark moment. Wonderful way to win a woman's heart. I should mention that while he was holding the bow and arrow in his hands and taking aim, the father of the bride was standing behind him with his bolo drawn, the large knife that they tie to their waist, and just ready to, well, you get the picture. And here, listen, here's the deal. You know, I know that there may be some couples that are going to get married like next fall or next spring or something, and if you would like to incorporate this into your wedding ceremony, please invite me. I would love to see it. I mean, I don't know. We've got some good hunters here, I'm sure. And yeah, you guys are going to go and say Jay recommended it, and then you'll sue me later when it all goes badly. But be that as it may, all kinds of ceremonies that went with getting married, but nothing would happen. No negotiations, no discussions, nothing would happen unless the young man who was courting this girl was able to illustrate for her father that he had taken a hit. That was always the first step. It was the passage into manhood. When a little boy was 4 years old or so, just able to talk to his father. How many fathers here have sons and are not ashamed to admit it? You've got sons. Okay, so work with me here. Listen to this story. Put yourself in their shoes, even though they didn't wear them back then. 4-year-old boy would be sitting across from you, your son, as he's begun to grow. You've just gotten to the place where you can communicate with him and you can tell him the most important things in life. And so you would say to him as a 4-year-old, son, someday you're going to grow up and be like me. You're going to be like me and like your uncle and like your grandfather. And you will go on a headhunt and you will take a hit. That was one of the first things that a little boy heard all the time that he was growing up that was in front of him. By the time your son was 12 years old or so, just kind of where his voice had begun to crack when he was talking, you would participate in a headhunt as the father of a 12-year-old son, go down into the village, and they tell stories of attacking, ambushing funeral processions, and I could tell you about the ambush, ambushing funeral processions and beheading everyone. And on that headhunt that you would participate in, you would actually take one of the arms or one of the legs from one of the victims and you would carry it back home. And if I were to find you on the trail while you were carrying it, and I were to say to you, where are you going with that? What are you doing with that? You would say in their language, I'm going to give this to my son. I'm taking this up into the mountains because I'm going to give this to my son so that he can become accustomed to. I could introduce you to people up there today who vividly remember their father wrapping his right hand around their right hand around a bolo and training. By the time your son was 18 years old, I am not making any of this up. And there's a point to why I want to tell you this story. I need you to understand what it was that God reached into. By the time your son was 18 years old or so, you would make a brand new bolo for him that had never been used before, a great big curved knife. And you'd make a sheath for it and make it all pretty and fancy and festive. And then you would unsheath it and you would hand it to your son. And he would tie the sheath around his waist, and he was not allowed to return the bolo to his waist, to its sheath, until he had used it for the purpose. Headhunting had spread far and wide. It was just endemic to the culture. It was part of who they were. It defined them. And it wasn't just the people in the lowlands. It wasn't just the people far away. It was the people in the other village. Mike, if you were from the village of, keep these villages in mind, okay? If you were from the village of Kauaian and I was from the village of Gingin and we met on the trail, culture demanded that that meeting would end with one of us dead. Modesty prevents me from saying who I think it would be. No, this would be up for grabs at this point. The man is head and shoulders taller than I am, so I'd... The village of Kauaian and the village of Gingin were constantly at war with one another. The very first brush that they had with human civilization, with Western civilization, was a man named William Jones. Dr. William Jones, in fact, and you could look him up, Google him on the internet, and you're going to find out that this guy actually went to live with these people. He wanted to figure out why it was that they were so violent. And so he got himself adopted into a family and actually spent about 6 weeks up there back in 1912. He had started to learn their language and was trying to figure out their culture, and he ran out of supplies over time. And he said to a few of the guys, would you walk down to the lowlands with me, and I'll buy some supplies, and you can help me carry them back up? So they agreed to do that. And in the process of that, an argument broke out between Mr. Jones and the Bukolot men over how much he was going to pay them. Can I give you just a quick rule of thumb? Never argue with a headhunter. I'm just saying, that was probably in the anthropology class. Maybe Mr. Jones, Dr. Jones slept through that, and I shouldn't make light of it because apparently Dr. Jones won his argument, and the reason I say that is because he lost his life. Killed him and threw him out into the lowlands. And by 1945, the next brush that they had with outside civilization was when MacArthur walked into Manila and forced the Japanese north. You know that part of the story of World War II? The Japanese left Metro Manila and they went north. What you might not know is that they went right into Bukolot territory. The Japanese army that had been occupying Manila walked right into the Sierra Madre, into Bukolot territory. And part of the reason that I know this is because I have a good friend there in the Philippines. He's one of the translators with SIL. His name is Takashi Fukuda. He's Irish. And I'm just kidding. He's not Irish. He's actually Japanese, surprisingly, with a name like that. But he's Japanese, and I was sitting checking some translation for him at one point, and came to be break time, and so we put our heads, you know, and we kind of sat back, and he said, so who do you work with? And I said, well, we work with a group of people called the Bukolot, and some people call them the Ilongot. His eyes just got big. He said, Jay, they are in all the Japanese history books because of what they did to the Japanese army in 1945. By 1954, the Philippine government had had all that it could take. They'd tried numerous things to try to placate and pacify the Bukolot people, and the only thing that they could think to do was to take the armies of the Philippines, take squadrons, well-armed squadrons, and walk through that territory up there and kill every Bukolot man and young man. They didn't know what else to do. To this day, it's a toss-up in my mind as to what would have actually happened, but that was the plan. That was the plan. During those days, back in 1954, there was a young fledgling organization in the Philippines called New Tribes Mission. Ketchums are part of New Tribes Mission. There may be other students here that are part of New Tribes Mission, somebody that I'm not seeing. But New Tribes Mission was just a fledgling organization back in those days. And so the guy who was the president of New Tribes Mission, ruling over maybe five or six people altogether, actually got an audience with the president of the Philippines, Ramon Magsaysay, and said, sir, please, you can't do this to this people group. You can't just wipe a people group off of the planet. Give us some time to send some missionaries up there, and you'll see. They'll change. They'll become Christians, and they'll stop the headhunting, and they'll stop the killing. And President Magsaysay was dubious, to say the least, but said, well, okay, it's worth a shot. You know, why don't you just go ahead? Could you do something with me? Could you just kind of take a a flight of fancy with me and go back to 1954, I realize that most of you would disappear, including me. But then church would be over much sooner. But let's just imagine that it's 1954, okay? And we are, this group right here is New Tribes Mission of the Philippines, okay? You tracking with me? And I'll say that I'm the president of New Tribes of the Mission of the Philippines just because I'm up here and you're sitting there, okay? But I come back and I say, hey, guys, I have great news. I just talked to the president and he has given us permission to send missionaries to the Bukolo. Now, taking into consideration that no one has ever crossed into Bukolo territory and lived to tell about it, could we have a couple of volunteers? Oh, I know, it's funny. But that actually happened. And an unmarried Filipino man named Florentino Santos and an unmarried American man named Marvin Graves stood up and said, we'll go. And I'm telling you right now, I am looking forward to being near those men when they receive their reward, just to watch it happen. Well, nobody had ever made peace with these people before. Nobody had ever reached into their society and successfully lived with them. No one had survived before. So we need a plan. Well, in the absence of a plan, they decided to buy themselves a tent and put up a tent down by the river in the lowlands outside of Bukolo territory. And then they were going to go hiking up into Bukolo territory during the day in the hopes of meeting a Bukolo man that was in a good mood. I don't know how this plan was going to unfold. And then they would talk to him or something. I don't know. Well, they set up their tent. They walked up, down by bedtime. They walked up the next day and down by bedtime, and this went on for a couple of weeks. And then one of the days that they were up in the rainforest up there, up in the jungle, they were wandering here and there, and they got lost. I don't know how many of you here have ever been lost in the jungle or lost in the rainforest. That's happened to me 3 times, and I do not recommend it. They got lost. And as night began to fall, it was clear they weren't going to get back to their tent, and so they ended up just kind of leaning against a big tree. And I don't know if you can picture this. There are noises that go on in the rainforest. I mean, there are cobras there that are up to 18 feet long, and pythons there that, well, I already told you a story about one of the pythons there. And there are monkeys and deer and wild hogs that can, anyway. I don't know what you would have been saying if that had happened to you.
Lord, I'm just trying to serve you, and this is the thanks I get? You won't let me find the trail?
I don't know. I don't even know that they did that. But they slept that night, leaning against a tree, and the next morning they got up and they found the trail and went, and it wasn't but 3 or 4 days later that as they were walking the trails during the day, they ran into a Bukolot man named Tanitan. Tanitan. And for some reason, when they said to him in Tagalog, in the national language there, they said, we are men who have come to you with a message from God, the Creator. Tanitan adopted them into his family. Gave them a place to live and to stay, and they started to learn the language and the culture, and it wasn't but 6 months or so later that Florentina was sitting there working on something when a group of Bukolot men came walking up to him and said, could we ask you a question? And Florentino said, sure. They said, do you remember when you were living in that cloth house down by the river? And Florentino's heart quickened just a little bit because they thought they were safe down there in that cloth house. And Florentino said, yeah, I remember that quite well. And they said, do you also remember the day that you went away from the cloth house in the daytime, but you didn't come back and sleep in the cloth house at night? I remember that, Florentino said. Can we ask you why you didn't come back to the cloth house? Well, we got lost. You have to understand tribal people. Lost in the rainforest. Men, the only thing that I can compare it to is if you were to tell your wife the reason I didn't come home last night was because I was at the mall and I got lost in the mall and couldn't find my car. If you're going to try that, again, invite me. I would love to be there to see how that unfolds. It doesn't make sense. Lost in the rainforest doesn't make sense to tribal people either. They said, you got lost? And Florentino said, yeah, we got lost. And they said, do you mean to say then, listen to this, do you mean to say then that you didn't know that we had surrounded the cloth house during that day and were waiting to kill you in your sleep that night? And Florentino said, no, we didn't know that, but the Buccalote assumed that they knew it. And anybody who has knowledge like that must have connection with somebody who sees from up there. And so when they ran into Tanitan and said that they were men who had come with a message from God to the Creator, first thing in Buccalote history that actually made sense. Well, they began to teach and to preach the gospel. And this headhunting came hard. I know what you must think. You know, these guys must have felt badly. I thought that when I was first up there, that you know, there would be these bewitching dances. And I sat down with my language assistant. I said, you know, there were these bewitching dances. And you would sing these limbai songs and the sending away songs. And then you would go on the hunt, and there's all kinds of adrenaline. And then you would come back after the hunt, and you were welcomed back by the women and with, you know, songs of rejoicing. But sooner or later, Dinong, his name was Bernardino Gabugin, and we called him Dinong. I said, you would have to get into your bed at night. You'd have to lay there on your bed mat, and it's just you and your heartbeat. And there must have been something that ticked in your heart that said, I've just ended the life of another man. I wish I could describe to you. When I said to him, didn't you feel badly about that? He looked at me like I had landed from another planet. And the only thing that he said, Jay, it's the most honorable thing a man can do. And the only thing that I can equate it to is that one of the Super Bowls fairly recently, the New England Patriots, who is my team, played the New York Giants. You may remember that Super Bowl. And if you were to sit down with the quarterback of the New York Giants after what they did to the New England Patriots that day, I think his name is Manning or something, I don't know. But if you were to sit down with him and say, Eli, I know you've won the Super Bowl, but don't you just feel a little badly about what you did to Tom Brady and the Patriots? How do you suppose he would respond? Are you kidding me? The gospel began to do its work. And Tanitan became the first believer. Until the day he died, they called him Abraham, the father of faith to the Buccalote people. Well, somebody got the idea, because there were missionaries working in Kauaian, and I'm almost done here. There were missionaries working in Kauaian, and there were missionaries working in Gingin. You remember the name of those two villages? And what happens when somebody from Gingin meets somebody from Kauaian on the trail? But there were missionaries working in each place, and there were believers in each place, and so somebody got the bright idea. We should get all the believers together for like a general believers conference, because that's like tradition. You get a bunch of believers, let's get them together. Forgetting perhaps that you can't have much of a church where all the believers are dead. We can have a great church cemetery, but that wasn't their goal. And so they called the believers from Gingin and the believers from Kauaian, and they got together in a place called Dabanganto, and I could take you there. I could take you to the very spot where this happened. The men, the women, and the children kind of stood back in the trees. There's this big clearing in Dabanganto, and the women and children stood back in the trees, and the men formed two semicircles just looking across at each other. And you have to remember, you have to understand that as I stood at this in this circle, as those men stood in this circle and looked at the man standing over there, there's the man that killed my brother, there's the man that killed my father, there's the man that killed my wife. And they stood there with their bows and arrows and their spears and their bolos tied around their waist and stared at each other. Nobody knew what to do. This had never been done before. Bob Gustafson, a good friend of mine who was there that day, told me the story of what unfolded next. He said, almost as though it was choreographed and personally, I believe it was choreographed by the Spirit of God himself. One of the men from the Gingin side began to walk toward the Kauaian side at exactly the same time as a man from the Kauaian side came in the opposite direction. And Bob said that they took the quiver off of their backs and laid their bow and arrows down at exactly the same time and took another few steps. And their spears that were held in their right hand, they laid those down just watching each other. And Bob said before you knew it, they were standing face to face. And he watched them do something that was absolutely unheard of in their culture. They began to untie the bolo from around their waist. And he heard one of the men say, we no longer need these. We're brothers now. They threw their arms around one another and began to weep. And the church was born. I wish you could visit there today. You probably don't want to go after that part of the story. But listen, today there are 20 strong churches in the 20 villages among the Bukolot. One of them has 14 pastors. Another one of them has 10 pastors. Another, they all have at least three. 65 to 70% of the Bukolot people have come to faith in Christ and are passionate about their faith. If you were to go there, we'd sing together. They sing a lot of modern songs, but there's a hymn that keeps coming up over and over and over again. It's one of their favorites. It's hymn number 10, if 3, Tampu Notugo. And you might not recognize it in their language. You might recognize it by the tune, but in their language they say in that first verse, Noomune matambulin mapanginoon diyot no tumabi makatag nito magu. Mapanan agum agum ito, di man ang adabat. Madak manumatawa mga dan. When the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time will be no more. When the morning breaks eternal, bright and fair, and the saved of this earth are gathered over on the other shore, and the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there. You know what that means today? That means even if you never go to the Philippines with me to meet these people, someday we're going to be standing in the presence of the King. And I don't know how long it's going to take before we could bear to take our eyes off of him. But you might glance to one side or the other and see a Bukolot man standing there. And I think you'll recognize him because I think he's going to be dressed like a Bukolot man. You've redeemed us from every kindred and tongue and people and nation, we're all going to say. I think we're going to look like what we look like. It's going to be part of the way we worship him because we are who we are. But you're going to look to one side or the other and you're going to see that Bukolot man standing there. Maybe you'll just turn to him and you'll say, hey, buddy, there was this big bald-headed guy that came once and told us a story, and I don't much remember his name, but I remember the story well enough to know that you were a pretty rough dude. What are you doing here? Let me promise you something. He's not going to mention the name Jay Jackson. He's not going to mention the name Florentino Santos or Marvin Graves or Del Schultz or... He's going to point to the throne. And he's going to say to you, I am here today because he was not willing that any should perish. Oh, it's not nearly the end of the story. I want to show you a video. It's 6 minutes, and then I have about 2 minutes to... But the video talks about something that's happened in the last 3 years. The Bukolot have taken personal responsibility as a people group to reach an unreached people group 400 miles to their south, a group called the Agda. 80,000 Agda that have never heard the gospel in their heart language. I want you to watch. I'm going by faith here that it's actually going to happen. Because while I can do the PowerPoint for you, I can't act out the video. So, watch. The blonde-headed kids are my grandchildren. Ooh. they're the children of our oldest daughter, Jennifer and Steve Hagen, who took it upon themselves to undertake a ministry among the Agda in an effort to reach the 80,000 that are down there, waiting to hear the gospel in their own language. They had learned Tagalog, and they went up to Bukolo territory because Jennifer grew up there, so for her it's like going home. They went up to Bukolo territory to just kind of take a break during their language study, at the end of their language study, and while they were up there, the men, the church leaders, actually asked Steve for a meeting. He said, you know, you speak Tagalog and you speak it very well. That's the national language. It's not their language, but you speak it very well. And so you should come and help us because... And Steve, being who Steve is, said, well, yeah, but, you know, I look around here and there's... Everywhere I look, there's churches and there's church leaders and there's believers. And down there where I live, there's not... There are no churches. There are no believers. Steve said, without missing a beat, the elder that was speaking on behalf of everybody else said, well, then maybe we should come and help you. Steve said. On his way through Metro Manila the next day, he called me on the phone and said, Dad, what do you think? And to make a very long and complicated story very short, today there are 7 Bukolot families and 3 singles who have made the trip from where the Bukolot live down to Agda territory. They've learned the language down there and they've begun to teach. And today there are almost 40 that have been baptized among the Agda. There are more than 100 that are listening to the teaching and 32 villages that are asking for a missionary to come and be with them. In the meantime, these missionaries have been sent out by a people group that has no money. And so we're also working very hard to plant a coffee plantation of some 2,700 acres up there in Bukolo territory so that they can have the wherewithal to support the missionaries that they've sent out. Perhaps Alman said it best, a guy named Alman Pasigian, a good friend of mine. We were sitting together one evening, and I really will close with this. We were sitting together one evening, and he said, Jay, he said, next time you and Steve come up, you should bring your video cameras. And I said, okay. He said, because we're going to make a movie. I said, oh, okay, sounds like a plan. I said, in the first place, nobody's going to watch a movie that Steve and I make with our video cameras. But in the second place, why would we do that? And this is what he said. He said, Jay, you know, you can argue with a man's philosophy, you can argue with his theology, you can argue with his ideas. But we used to be headhunters, and now we're sending out missionaries, and you can't argue with what happened to us. I agree. The short side of that is we've found a director who's very interested in making the movie and a studio has put up the funds, and starting next summer, we're going to be making the movie of that story with lots of others that bits and pieces that I didn't tell you, and I hope you're going to be able to see it in theaters by 2014 sometime, but that's not the point I want to make. The point I want to make is that when I stood up here and there's all these lights up here and I said, it's December and Merry Christmas, I don't want you to miss this. There was a time in your history when you lived in darkness, just like the Bukolo. And the only thing that would solve your problem, the only thing that would meet your need, was if God the Father was willing to send his one and only Son, because he loved the world so well, to die in our place. And I want us to understand as we walk into this Christmas season, that when the one and only Son was the one and only thing that would meet our need, according to Romans chapter 8 and verse 32, God spared not his own Son, but delivered him up freely for us all. So as we enter this holiday season, my prayer for you is that you won't forget that. That will be in the front of your mind. His indescribable gift to you. Pray for me as I head out tomorrow morning. I'm well past tired at this point. Well past tired. I've said amen, and it's still raining. Have you heard that song? But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear him whisper through the rain, "I'm with you." And that's our hope. Would you stand with me in his presence? Father and our God, it's taken a long time to tell a story that's far longer and more complicated than we could ever begin to explain. We want to unite our hearts together today, Father, on behalf of the Bukalot, and just say, thank you that you were not willing that they should perish. But you hazarded your people. You sent them into that dark and dangerous place, and they shared the gospel with courage and with trust in you. God, it isn't just the Bukalot. It's the Agta. It's the 6,500 unreached people groups around the planet that we're praying for this morning. We pray, God, that you would raise up workers and send them. We pray for ourselves, Father, as we enter this holiday season, that we would be able to keep it front and foremost in our minds. That what it's really about is a celebration of the day that the King left the throne room and slept in a manger that night. We bless your name. And we thank you for that. In the name of the Lord Jesus.